Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
You all know that I can't believe Raymond has gifts to get on Mother's Day, both for his mother and the beautiful Rebecca. And that's coming up May 12th. So if you haven't gotten mom something special yet, you have to do it. And you never go wrong with great flowers. You just never do. They always brighten up someone's day, especially when they come from, and I love this, fromyouflowers.com. It has a fantastic deal right now, just for my podcast listeners. So you go to fromyouflowers.com/Laura, and you can send a dozen mixed roses for just $19.99, or if you need to make a really great impression, just upgrade to 2 mixed dozen roses and add a free vase for just $10 more. So that's $29.99 for a big arrangement, 24 roses, a free vase, delivered in time for all the special moms on your list this Mother's Day. Again, fromyouflowers.com/Laura. And you can go there. You'll see that there's guaranteed freshness, on-time delivery from a company that was awarded the highest customer satisfaction with online flower retailers in 2019 by the esteemed J.D. Power. Again, very easy. Mother's Day, do the right thing. fromyouflowers.com/Laura.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Welcome to the Best of the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Thanks for listening. There's so many memorable guests and unforgettable moments from both radio over the years, conversations, my most incredibly scintillating guests, all unforgettable. Enjoy it here on the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Bernie, well, he's at his town hall on Fox. And
you know, when you wrote the book and you made the money,
yeah,
isn't that the definition of capitalism, the American dream?
No. I mean, you know, what we want is a country where everybody has opportunity. You know, I have a college degree. Like, I'm a United States senator. But a lot of people don't have a college degree. A lot of people are not United States senators. I want everybody in this country to be able to have health care, to have education, to, when they turn on the water, have drinkable water, not toxic water.
So you notice how Bernie Sanders just deflects and says, well, everybody has to have an opportunity to get clean health care and drinkable water, or good health care. Okay. Again, that's what a prosperous society can provide her people. If a society is not prosperous and we don't have a vibrant middle class that exists when a country protects its manufacturing, protects its industry, continues to grow and innovate with the help of less government regulation and lower taxes, if you don't do that, then everybody's going to live in poverty. Except the elite of the elite, the upper echelon of the government, as we see with China and we still see in Russia, where we have a lot of really rich people and a very small middle class. That's what you see in Russia now. I mean, when I was there, I was stunned at how much had changed, but in a way, how little had changed. Money was concentrated only among a certain subset of the population. So the wonder of America is the American dream, which they revile now. It's a mother and a father and three kids and a dog and a white picket fence. That's over. That era is over. Good riddance. That was a great era for this country. A great era. Not to say everything was perfect. Everyone had perfect civil rights. No, we had work to do. But just the idea of people being able to make a living. If a mom or a dad wants to stay home with kids, they can stay home with kids. Because guess what? One person makes enough money to support the family. And then you can raise your kids and be with the kids. And maybe occasionally go on a vacation. I mean, this is good stuff. This is good family-centered stuff. And if that's controversial for these people, then okay, we can just make that argument to the American. That is what most Americans want. That is what most Americans hope to have in their lives, a life that is not tangled up in government regulation, where people can pursue their own destinies and not be taxed into oblivion. That's what they would like, not be saddled with massive debt either, which is why, you know, we'll talk about this college education issue and whether we We really need college education. 4 years of college education for all people.
Yes, we do. We need it. And we
Everybody.
Need it for free. Everybody should have it. Why not?
Well, for free. I love that. He's becoming the count in Sesame Street.
He's Waldorf and Stadler.
One, two, three, four.
Up in the balcony.
Well, Milton Friedman, of course, spoke eloquently about the free market and free enterprise.
So far as poverty is concerned, there has never in history been a more effective machine for eliminating poverty than the free enterprise system and the free market. The period in... The period in which you had the greatest improvement in the lot of the ordinary man was the period of the 19th and early 20th century. Those of us in this room are the heirs of that. We benefited from the way in which our parents and our grandparents were able to come here. And by virtue of the freedom that was offered to them, were able to make a better life for themselves and them and us. But next, if you look at the real problems of poverty and denial of freedom to people in this country, almost every single one of them is a result of government action and would be eliminated if you eliminated the bad government failures.
He was such a genius in so many ways. And again, but not these people read any of this. They don't. It's reflexive, driven by a top line on social media. No one reads an article. No one watches the full video. No one, not no one, but most people who emote rather than think. And even people who are super smart, have done really well academically, it's easier to emote than to think. And I would say that, look, Buttigieg's dad was a Marxist professor, okay? Marxist writer and professor. And I think there is a lot in the Marxist ideology and the Marxist thinking that sounds on its surface to be quite liberating. You know, we're going to unite against the evil, corrupt bosses, the oligopolies, the monopolies. We will strike back at this and strike a blow for workers' rights and workers' freedom and so forth. And you hear echoes of that in the way the Democrats are addressing these big issues. But that never leads to more freedom. What they are selling never leads to more freedom. It leads to more poverty, repression, suppression of free speech, as we're seeing not just on college campuses, but around the United States. People are afraid to speak out, afraid to say anything today. And I think for fear of being branded X, where X has been determined to be, make you an untouchable. People are afraid. So in this world of, we're the people who want more freedom. No, they don't. They don't want more freedom, maybe to have an abortion or what comes with, you know, sexual relationships, maybe that. But not more freedom, not really. Freedom is contracting in the world where government is growing.
Right. No, they want more government expansion to force a particular point of view, a particular vision of America on everybody else. And imagine if conservatives were attempting to do that, to use the government to stop freedoms. They would be marching on Washington every day of the week.
Right.
You can't. That's not the government's role. We are the government. We are. And therefore, we can't have this thing crushing down on us and our abilities and our initiatives. And that's really at the heart of what's being advanced here. I have to say I'm shocked by the brazenness, though, of these agenda items, from the New Green Deal to talk of stopping and getting rid of the Electoral College. This should make people just I'm shocked at the lack of shock. I don't think people fully process what is being advanced here and how really radical and bizarre this is in the context of America.
I also think it's a good opportunity for Republicans to go to some of these smaller states that they had lost election after election. I'd go into New England and I'd say, these people want to completely minimize your role in electing a president of the United States. I'd go to Vermont and Connecticut and I'd go to New York. If I were Trump, I'd go right to New York. I'd say, okay, you see what your state has done? New York City's about to go bankrupt. Next 4 years, New York's going to be bankrupt. They're going to look for a federal bailout. You know it's coming. New York is on the rails. Connecticut, a mass exodus of jobs. I would not cede the territory of New England. I wouldn't. I know it's because I'm from New England, and I hate the fact that so much of New England is lost. But I would say these people who claim to be your great liberators want to run roughshod over any electoral input you might have in this election by having California and New York and maybe Illinois and Florida run the show. I guess maybe Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is still a pretty big electoral foothold. But I don't think that works. So again, the tone of Mayor Pete, he's so nice and he's so this. I would rather have one of the things that I like least, and I've understood this over time. Raymond knows what I'm talking about here. Someone who on the surface appears to be so nice and opening doors for people. Hi, you look great today. How are you? It's great to see you. How you doing? I sent a check and donated to the charity. And oh, it's wonderful to see you. How are the kids? And then you turn around and those people are the biggest frauds ever. I would rather have someone who is, you know what, to the wall and is a little rough around the edges. But when push comes to shove, it's not going to stick a shiv in your back or betray you. Those are the people I like. And it's nice to have your, you know, manners and all that too. But yeah, you know what I'm saying. It's like the perfect picture of the well-coiffed and the this. What does that do? Not in this rough and tumble world we live in. Double chin, sagging jawlines, come on, skin around your neck. Those are the real problems until now. Introducing the new GenuCell jawline treatment formulated with MDL technologies. This Mother's Day, don't miss GenuCell's outrageous Mother's Day sale. Robin from Lubbock, Texas loves it. She said she put that jawline cream on her neck 2 or 3 days ago. It's the best her neck has looked in years. Several people told her face looks better, looks younger. She's blown away. Love hearing the comments. Sure, expensive treatments, you could get those, or gosh, harsh treatments, you don't want those. To look younger, none of that. Come on, guys, why would you do that? From now until Mother's Day, the GenuCell jawline treatment is yours absolutely free when you order the GenuCell Classic for under-eye bags and puffiness. Has instant effects, you'll see the results fast, guaranteed or your money back. Go to GenuCell.com, that's GenuCell.com, or just text EYES1 to 77453, and a special surprise, a premium Mother's Day gift with all orders. Text EYES1 to 77453 or visit GenuCell.com, that's GenuCell.com. Joining us now, speaking of, is one of our favorite straight talkers. Pat Buchanan, who is, you know, he's a national treasure in my mind, and he was so far ahead of the curve on so many issues for so many years that it's, for me, this is like, when I talk to Pat, it's like going home again, and I'm just so happy he's with us. Pat Buchanan, how are you? Good to talk to you.
Doing fine. National treasure was a phrase, I think, introduced by Jimmy Carter about Andrew Young, if you'll recall, our ambassador to the U.N.
Well, Pat, come on. Your day is only going to get, you know, worse after being called a national treasure on my show here. So it's only this is like the height of your. I'm just kidding you. So Pat, well, there's so much to get to, but I do have to get your take on the media's rush to embrace and venerate this Pete Buttigieg from South Bend, Indiana. And it's almost entirely on the basis of first, you know, he would be the first gay president, the first gay president who's married and has a spouse living in the White House. And it's about his tone and about how he's soft spoken. He speaks like this, and it's none of the tumultuous rhetoric of Trump. But it's amazing how they have rushed in to embrace him. And now we have a report today that all these former Obama people, Susan Rice, Jay Carney, others are donating to his campaign, a shadow government in waiting to get back in.
Well, I think what it is in part, certainly, is this, that this is a gay man who's in a same-sex marriage, and the fact that they stand beside him and support him and stand up for him puts them, I think, in a certain superior moral plane in the community they're in. We're standing by this fellow. It's as though, look, we were marching at Selma Bridge with the folks who were standing up for civil rights, et cetera. This is the cause du jour. And so I think It's a testimony to where they want to place themselves. And by praising Mayor Pete and hailing Mayor Pete for his courage, it also says something about them. But there is, I do agree with what you said before. They did a contrast this morning on one of those TV cable shows between how Donald Trump talked about people disrupting his rallies and how Mayor Pete talked about somebody disrupting his rally yesterday. And I will say the contrast was dramatic. And Mayor Pete was certainly sweet about it, you know, and saying, well, that's your view sort of thing. And the Donald was really ripping them. So it was quite something. But I think people, they take a stand on issues. Some folks naturally do in order to tell the world where they stand. And there's a lot of folks that are saying, look, we are for this. We stand for Pete. We stand behind him and his marriage. We think that is right, just as Mayor Pete says. And that is who we are also.
I think we as Americans have to decide for ourselves whether our tradition of Western civilization and our history and our monuments and our writers and our poets and are worth preserving. I mean, that's really kind of what's undergirding all of this. I mean, we see it with a debate about how Notre Dame should be rebuilt. Pat, I'm sure you've seen it, but now the thought among the elites in Europe is that it should be rebuilt as a interdenominational house of worship.
Well, you know, I think that's preposterous. The reaction to what happened at Notre Dame, in my view, and I'll tell you who's written on it magnificently, is in the Chronicles, is Tom Piatak, who's a friend of mine and who just sent me a copy of his blog. It's as long as a syndicated column, but it is just beautiful in Chronicles. And I do think its Catholicism is integral to its enormous appeal, I think. It's Christian roots of it, the longevity of it, the fact that this represents the faith that was at the core of Western civilization that came out of the dying Roman Empire, and this is the heart of France, Catholic France, the eldest daughter of the Church. I mean, it is a religious building, and it ought to be maintained as what it is. And the idea, I mean, why do people, I mean, frankly, if many of these modern churches went down, no one would want to see them crash and burn. But they would not be as affect people the way this has done. And I think it's got to do with the fact that, look, this is Mother Church of Europe, and not only of France, but of Europe and of Western civilization. So, I mean, the idea of putting some modern structure in its place would never and will never, in my judgment, because it's not rooted in the truth that the Notre Dame was, it would never attain the kind mm-hmm. of reverence and respect Notre Dame has with peoples, many of whom are not Catholics, many of whom are not Christians, and many of whom are not even Europeans.
Yeah, well,
European descent.
Right. Well, treating it as just an iconic structure, if I heard that phrase one more time, or a museum, which is when you go into, I was saying this yesterday, Pat, when I was in Switzerland this summer and I was in Zurich, and I went into some of these beautiful cathedrals that are, you know, of course, that in the Reformation were completely robbed of all of their statuary and relics and the altar. I got profoundly depressed in these spectacularly beautiful on the outside cathedrals and beautiful churches, but it was all denuded of the meaning.
Yeah, and some of those churches are being turned into condos,
right?
You know, in Europe. You know,
right.
I recall I was on a trip to Eastern Europe. As a matter of fact, right around the time that Gorbachev sent troops into Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. And I think it was in Latvia that we went into, they always take you into, this is the old city. And they went in and they said this church was, this is a Lutheran church. I think it was built in the 14th century. I said, that's one of ours that's been taken over, my friend. There were no Lutheran churches in the 14th or whatever century it was. But you're exactly right. Many of the churches that have been dotted in Europe that still survive all this were originally Catholic before the Reformation, and some of them as the Protestant churches have basically, and I wrote on that this week, many of the Protestant churches, mainstream churches, have been losing their congregations dramatically to today, where those Americans who profess no religion, which is 23%, are probably twice as numerous as those who profess traditional mainstream Protestant religions, such as, you know, Presbyterians and Methodists and Episcopalians and Lutherans.
We're talking to Pat Buchanan here on the Laura Ingraham podcast. Mike Pence spoke about the relentless criticism he's received from Mayor Pete on the issue of his faith and Christianity. This is what he said.
You know, I've known Mayor Pete for many years. We worked very closely together when I was governor, and I considered him a friend. He knows I don't have a problem with him. I don't believe in discrimination against anybody. I treat everybody the way that I want to be treated. I think Pete's quarrels with the First Amendment. All of us in this country have the right to our religious beliefs.
But Buttigieg, of course, himself said, no, 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 no. He supported the Religious Restoration Act in Indiana. And the Religious Restoration Act would have allowed for, quote, discrimination, close quote, against people like Mayor Pete and his spouse in terms of, you know, accommodations and so forth. Let's listen.
The vice president is entitled to his religious beliefs. My problem is when those religious beliefs are used as an excuse to harm other people. That was a huge issue for us in Indiana when he advanced a discriminatory bill in 2015 under the guise of religious freedom that said it was lawful to discriminate provided you invoked religion as your excuse. And I just believe that's wrong. This isn't about him as a human being. This is about policies that hurt people, policies that hurt children. And you'll notice that to this day, he has not brought himself to say that it shouldn't be legal to discriminate against people in this country because they're LGBT.
Well, he's demanding that everyone get in line with a more progressive view on every conceivable social issue. Really. I mean, it's really every issue. It's beyond marriage and all of that. It's to every issue. And if you don't line up with this progressive view of the world, we will call you every name in the book, even if you've been nice to me in the past. And others will pile on, and then he will be perceived and portrayed in the media, Pat, as the great moral arbiter. But they never pull this stuff on the Muslims. You notice that the Muslims never get the demands issued to them about marriage or any of these other issues.
Well, there's a number of levels on which this is quite a conflict. One of them, you know, Mayor Pete says, you know, basically, I'm as the Creator made me, and he implies I'm living the good Christian life, and you who say that I'm not, you're wrong. You're dead wrong. And on that level, you're talking about really a religious clash between beliefs, because there's no doubt about traditional Catholicism, holds that homosexuality and homosexual acts are morally everywhere and always wrong, and that it reflects a moral disorder in individuals who move in this direction. And what Pete is saying is the traditional teachings of the Catholic Church and other Christian religions on the matters of homosexuality are morally and theologically wrong. In other words, what the Church has been teaching, say, for at least 1900 years, that is wrong. And that's on one level, which is one I saw him challenging Pence on, which seemed to me to be Pete going beyond just the claim that, look, I'm a homosexual. This is the same-sex marriage has been approved by the Supreme Court. That's what I'm engaged in. That's what I believe in. And I have a right to that belief. And I think we should use the law to prevent any kinds of discrimination in terms of, like, the baked cake situation against those who are engaged in same-sex marriage. So you're in a real conflict here between what is being called, if you will, by the left and the progressive, now a new civil right, the right not to be discriminated against if you're a homosexual and you're engaged in a homosexual union, and not being discriminated against for that. And then on the other side is the idea that, look, we believe, because we're traditional Christians, that this lifestyle is wrong and we should not be involved in some, you know, some secular acts which promote it or suggest that we approve of it. So you got a real conflict here. And my own view is that, or there's no question, we talked earlier, the elites, the progressives and the folks on the in the media are using this as an example to show where they stand, and it's on the other side. So this is why I wrote the column earlier this week. I think this is going to introduce, if you will, these moral questions right into the politics of 2020.
Well, and I think, again, he's made a calculation regarding
this. I think he's right. I think you're right in this sense. I mean, he knows when you get into a presidential race and you're married to a man and you say, he's my husband, I mean, you're going to jolt an awful lot of people. And I think the very fact that he's done that, he also, clearly he has prepared his responses. And again, he knows that there are folks who are going to rise to defend him on this. But at the same time, I mean, I think I heard somewhere this morning that, you know, 70% of Americans don't believe you should discriminate against an individual, I think, involved in a same-sex union. But there's a huge slice of America that doesn't believe that is moral or right or true, no matter what the Supreme Court
is. Yeah,
I
mean, it's like with abortion, right? I mean, the court thinks it settles it, but it doesn't settle it. It just proclaims something, and
it
doesn't settle it for millions of Americans. And I think that's what this – he wants to draw Pence into a conversation about this, assuming that the conversation in the debate will propel him ahead of the Democrat pack.
I think that's what's going to happen. I think he's going to get hit with a question at the Democratic debates on this, and he's got his answers down cold, and his answers are frankly will be extremely well received by most of the audience at those Democratic mm-hmm. debates. And I think but at the same time, there are people going to be listening who are unaware of his union who become aware then. So I think it clearly is one of those, it really is a polarizing issue. And a lot of folks, will go for him because of it. And a lot will go against him, I think, quietly and privately because of it.
Well, I think it's interesting that the moralizers today, at least the ones who are talking about these issues a lot, seem to be the people on the left. I mean, to me, no one's talking about his faith except him. I mean, his sexual orientation except him. Who's talking about it? So it's moralizing. You must believe this. You must believe this, or we condemn you. So it's the modern day Salem witch trials. They're putting Pence at the stake. And anyone else like him? I mean, the Muslims, again, they always get off the hook, even though Quran chapter, 4:16,
exactly right.
Their
in
comments.
The eyes, in the eyes of the, well, we can take the quotes, but in the eyes of liberal progressives, there's no doubt about it. There's a feeling that not only are they morally correct, but that the Trumpistas, if you will, or the Trumpians, are morally backward. I mean, look what Hillary and Bernie have both said. Of course, Bernie confined it to Trump. He's a racist, sexist, homophobe, misogynist, bigot. But Hillary said his supporters, half of his supporters were deplorables. They are racist, sexist, homophobe, xenophobe, Islamophobe, bigots. In other words, because their beliefs and their expression of their beliefs make them bad people. And in the eyes of an awful lot of Democrats and liberals and progressives, the Trump base, as they call it, and that is not a positive term in their eyes, represents pretty much exactly that. People that haven't come forward into the new progressive era and whose views are backward and reactionary and wrong and the rest of it. And that's why we're in a situation where you know, the sides are calling each other. The names that are being called are unbelievable. It never used to be that way. I mean, I keep referring to the 50s and up into the mid-60s, where the disagreements among Democrats and Republicans were more on issues, you know, of foreign policy, economics, social security, things like that. But they're now about the most basic moral, cultural, social beliefs of what is right and wrong and good and evil. And there's a tremendous clash there. And that's the heart of the culture war.
Everyone knows how much I love my dogs. They deserve the best, and I try to treat them pretty well. They have a pretty good life here, the Ingram and the Ingram family. And there are so many animals out there who've been abandoned, mistreated. And the Delta Rescue is the largest no-kill, care-for-life animal sanctuary of its kind in the world. Its super sanctuary is home to more than 1,500 animals, and they've all been abandoned in the wilderness. So you can help keep this beautiful mountaintop ranch going, its mission going. It's a mission of compassion by including Delta Rescue in your estate plans. 100% of your donations go directly to the animals of the Delta Rescue Super Sanctuary. You can't take it with you, my friend. So why not give a long-lasting, you know, and life-saving gift to those who can't care for themselves? For information on Delta Rescue's tax-saving estate planning options, visit deltarescue.org/Laura. Visit deltarescue.org/Laura. Learn more about the great benefits of your estate bequest. Donate today at deltarescue.org/Laura. Thanks for listening to the best of the Laura Ingram podcast.
I'm talking with the chief of the sector in Del Rio, the new chief, Raul Ortiz. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thank you all for having me. This has been a certainly an opportunity for us to talk a little bit about what's happening here on the border and really tell our story from the eyes of the Border Patrol agents and the citizens that live here.
Chief, the thing that shocked me the most, and you talked about it on Laura's show the other night, was how these cartels use these families as decoys, and in some cases, so they're making money off of their decoys while using them to divert your resources. Explain that to people. This is a part of the crisis I don't think anyone outside of your sector here and your agents really understand.
Yeah, the entire 2,000 miles of the southwest border are controlled by either cartels, plaza bosses, or transnational criminal organizations. So nothing crosses that river without their permission or without paying some sort of diesel or fine or fee to the smuggling organizations. So this is what funds the violence in Mexico. This is what funds the weapons that are coming south from the United States into Mexico, and also the public corruption that occurs on both sides of the border. And so for us, not only are we battling this border security threat, but we're also battling this transnational criminal organization threat that's exposing our agents to violence on the river itself. Just today, our agents were rocked as they were responding to rescues. And these organizations recognize that we are vulnerable out there because we are stretched awfully, awfully thin. We don't have enough agents to patrol the immediate border area. We're 2,000 under our mandate. And so we certainly need to hire more agents. We need more technology, and we need more infrastructure.
When people say there's a crisis on the border, in Washington they say there's no crisis on the border. It's a humanitarian crisis to care for these migrants. You would say what?
I would say that there is a humanitarian crisis. I would say there's a border security crisis, and I would say there's a policy crisis. And certainly the Border Patrol agents, we own the border security mission, and so we're going to do everything we can to focus on that. But we cannot lose sight of the fact that there's got to be some policy adjustments for us to be able to remedy the situation that's going on right now.
Chief Ortiz, this mission, though, of Border Patrol, your mission has really expanded. I mean, let's face it, you were not initially trained. When you entered Border Patrol, I'll bet you were not trained to do the things that you and your agents are now called to do. Explain a bit of that and how it is taxed. I see these men and women adjusting in the processing center and throughout the process. It's become a very difficult mission here.
Yeah. We talk about the border environment. It's probably the most complicated border environment we've ever experienced in, you know, since we were enacted in 1924 as an agency. And so what our agents are having to do right now is they're having to care and feed for unaccompanied children and family units. And we're having to make sure that we provide medical care across the board to everyone that we encounter. So far, you know, over 400,000 arrests by the Border Patrol. And so Every single one of those are requiring some sort of processing or adjudication. And then, you know, that's not even taking into consideration the individuals we're seeing from these other countries, special interest aliens, you know, from the Middle East or, you know, other countries outside of the Northern Triangle countries. Alone in some of our sectors, you know, 50 different countries, 30 different countries, 40 different countries.
Wow.
So I think, you know, Middle America thinks that, well, we're dealing with Guatemalans, El Salvadorans, and Hondurans, and Mexicans. No, this is an onslaught by folks from all across the globe.
So you are turned into investigators, rescue workers, medical triage technicians, child care specialists, and you're out. You have a marine mission where you're patrolling this river that is very open and very large.
Yeah.
How do you keep this up at this funding level with this manpower? You're stretched. I can see it.
Yeah. Fortunately, we have great support from our communities. We have great support from our families, and then certainly great interagency cooperation across the state, local, and federal partners that we have out there. So we know it's not just us on the front lines. We're sharing, you know, this problem set with a slew of other agencies that are trying to impact it as much as they possibly can.
There's a national debate, as you know, about the wall. I know you can't get into politics, and I don't want you to. But I do want your thoughts on what more fencing would mean to you. Now, you and I talked earlier. We were traveling all day with you along this sector, in car, on the water. You said we don't need a wall from one end of the country to the other. What do we need? What would be effective to you and your agents?
Yeah, we certainly need infrastructure, fencing and roads and technology in urbanized areas. We need it in strategic locations where these organizations are taking advantage of the lack of access that our Border Patrol agents have. So we have to be able to patrol as close to the border as we possibly can. Right now it's very limited because of the water flow that's coming through the Rio Grande. It's very limited because we have access issues in some of these private properties. And then certainly the terrain itself is very dense, and it's difficult to traverse. And so for our agents, we want to make sure that they have the tools out there to perform this mission.
I just have to tell you, and thank you on behalf of Laura and myself, this has been an education. One I wish the rest of the country could take part in, and because of you, they were able to do it. So I hope it does some good. God bless you for what you're doing and your agents.
Thank you all very much.
I hope you're enjoying this. I'm the Lower Income Podcast. This is the best of. And thank you for listening. We love your feedback. Always love your opinions. Want to hear from you. So you can email the show at ingram.podcast@gmail.com. That's ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Email me with your thoughts, or if you want to get on the show, just email me the topic you want to talk about or react to the topic we're tweeting or Facebooking out. Ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Keep the comments coming. Oh, by the way, Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. You watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. No credit card needed, no sign up. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. So what are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today. America, now and forever, you're listening to the best of the Laura Ingram Podcast. All right, joining us now on the Laura Ingram Podcast, the brilliant, the irreplaceable, Tom Sold. His book, Discrimination and Disparities. Disparities is just out in a revised and enlarged edition. It's fantastic. You will love it. It's on our Facebook page and lauraingram.com. We had him on the Ingram Angle a few nights ago, and he was fantastic, of course. I haven't talked to him in way too long and very excited to talk to him. And his book is more important now than ever since we're hearing a lot about income inequality and the need to equalize lifestyles, reparations, socialism. We're going to get into all these topics with him. Dr. Soul, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
It's great to talk to you. I got to play something for you, Tom. This is Kamala Harris, your senator in California. and I know you two are tight. And Julian Castro, who's also running for president, about this possibility of widespread reparations paid for the sins of slavery. Let's listen.
We had over 200 years of slavery. We had Jim Crow for almost a century. We had legalized discrimination and segregation, and now we have segregation and discrimination that is not legal but still exists and is a barrier to progress. We have disparities around housing. We have disparities around education. We have disparities around income. And we have to recognize that everybody did not start out on an equal footing in this country. And in particular, black people have not. And so we have got to recognize that and do something about that and give folks a lift up.
I have long believed that this country should resolve its original sin of slavery, and that one of the ways we should consider doing that is through reparations for people who are the descendants of slaves. It is interesting to me that under our Constitution and otherwise, that we compensate people if we take their property. Shouldn't we compensate people if they were property?
Take it away, Dr. Scholl.
You know, it's so pathetic. Nowhere in this world have I ever found, after decades of research, anywhere where all people were equally represented, or even approximately equally represented, in almost any endeavor that people are free to engage in. It's just staggering. As for slavery, the idea that they think this is American original sin. As of the time the United States was formed, slavery existed everywhere on the face of this planet except in Western Europe. And Adam Smith pointed this out in 1776 when his book came out at the same time that the United States was being put together. But what was different about the United States was that many of the northern states outlawed slavery. In other words, slavery was not something that was peculiar to the United States or to Western civilization. I doubt seriously if most of the slaves in the world or slave owners were either black or white, since it was all over the world. That's madness. The other thing, let's suppose that we do accept the proposition. My gosh, if you were to compensate all the people who were descendants of slaves, I suspect that would be a large and probably majority of the human race.
Yeah, I mean, and when you think about how, just practically speaking, forget about the taking money from people who had nothing to do with slavery. And giving it to people who, you know, may have a line into someone who was subjected to slavery. But just practically, what is everyone going to take DNA tests? I mean, if you were a certain percentage versus another percentage, would you get more or less?
We get into the Elizabeth Warren problem.
What is it? One over 1216. But remember, Tom, she talked about her high cheekbones that her pawpaw told her she had.
My gosh. Use the Elizabeth Warren standard. The great majority of all black Americans would have to be reclassified as white.
Okay, that is – I haven't heard it put that way. That's really funny. All right, but David Brooks in the New York Times says, because he's been so right on so many issues over the years – He's an acceptable Republican in the New York Times eyes. David Brooks says he's come around to the idea of reparations. You see this? They're mainstreaming this. He is a complete buffoon. I'm sorry. I don't care how good a writer he is. He's a buffoon.
Oh, the question is really, you can ask ourselves, it's no question to go back to roots. That Kunta Kinte, you know, was made worse off by being brought to America as a slave. The question is, was Alex Haley made worse off? And the answer clearly is no in the case of Alex Haley, even before he wrote Roots. When he went back to the place where his ancestors supposedly came from in Africa, he did not find them better off than he is. So I don't know. These are the kinds of arguments that are made for people who do not bother to stop and think. And I don't mean Kamala Harris and the other person. I mean the people they're addressing and whom they're addressing, knowing that there are vast numbers out there who will just grab on to whatever is emotionally satisfying and will not stop and think through what they're saying.
You in your book, you write about social visions and human consequences, and in this chapter, it really does, in many ways, address this idea of, well, life's not fair. We don't all have the same outcomes. I mean, listening to Kamala Harris, it's just a stunner to me. Yeah, you're right. Not everybody starts off on equal footing. Welcome to world history. So what are we supposed to do about that? I mean, I'm reading what you wrote on page 154 about, you know, the parallel, that more than a parallel between nature's outcomes and human outcomes is involved, since human beings have lived and evolved over the centuries and millennia in a very different geographic settings, some of which facilitate and others impede the development of both physical wealth and human capital behind the creation of wealth and the evolution of societies. In other words, guess what? Things are different all over.
Well, in the 2010 census, the poorest county in the United States was 90+% white. And it was the same county that was the poorest county at the end of the 19th century. Geography just dooms many people. There's no way people up in mountains are going to have the same opportunities in life as people born in seaports.
Well, that's an excellent point. Well, then you need seaport to mountain reparations. Clearly, you need some type of balancing here. And Hillary Clinton speaking about all this. Let's listen.
I was the first person who ran for president without the protection of the Voting Rights Act, and I will tell you, it makes a really big difference. And it doesn't just make a difference in Alabama and Georgia. It made a difference in Wisconsin, where the best studies that have been done said somewhere between 40 and 80,000 people were turned away from the polls because of the color of their skin, because of their age, because of whatever excuse could be made up to stop a fellow American citizen from voting.
She is wrong about that, of course, and the Washington Post just, I mean, and it's a Washington Post, and it gave her four Pinocchios, meaning basically your pants are on fire, you're lying.
But again, I don't think the question of whether what she was saying was true or not really concerned her at all.
What matters
is whether it will win politically. I mean, Harry Reid, former majority leader, said it all when he accused Romney of something during the 2012 election. And later on, someone said the accusation turned out to be completely false. And Harry Reid's answer, as I recall, was, it worked, didn't it?
But social justice, and you tackle this in your chapter on facts, assumptions, and goals. Social justice sounds really good. Oh, I'm for social justice.
So am I.
Sounds great. Yeah, we are too. But it's not determined by government bureaucrats in some cement building in Washington. That's not where it comes from.
No, and it's trying to do the impossible and making reality worse than it is. There's virtually no one of the key things that the redistributionists never ask themselves is it even possible to do what they want to do in any comprehensive and sustainable sense? Any number of countries have confiscated the wealth of individuals. In some places, they've forced the people to leave the country. They've expelled people and forced them to leave all their physical wealth behind. But, of course, the physical wealth is only produced by the human wealth inside their heads. And that you cannot confiscate. And so I'm thinking, one, the Jews expelled at the end of the 15th century from Spain. Well, they had to leave all their wealth behind in Spain, and they arrived destitute in various other places, including the Netherlands. Well, fast forward a few years, the Jews now have risen to prosperity again, and Spain starts its decline after expelling the Jews, the Moriscos, and other people who were productive. Same thing happened in the 1970s when Uganda expelled Asians, forced them to leave all their money, all their physical wealth behind. The physical wealth is used up, and when it's used up, if there's no one there to replace it, then the Ugandan economy is worse off than they were before.
You just reminded me when we were talking about the social justice and reparations. what is going on in a place like South Africa. Now, we don't talk enough about, frankly, what's happening around the world on television, but we have more time to do it here on the podcast. In South Africa, post-apartheid, you actually write about apartheid in your book, too. But after apartheid, there is this effort to equalize everything. And I'm sure you've read about what's happened in places like Zimbabwe, yeah, and now in South Africa. And I've met some of these ranchers when I was in Botswana a few summers ago, where people are actually just having their land taken from them.
Yeah.
With no compensation. And it's because you're white, you can't have this anymore. Even if you had nothing to do with how things were before, it's taken from you.
And the question is what are the consequences for everybody?
Mm-hmm.
All right. The whites lose their land. They go somewhere else in the world and have to start over again. But then if there's no one or not enough people there with the same ability to use that land, then, of course, you're going to have a lower output. I mean, land confiscation is one of the things that's been tried over and over again. And it depends on if you take the land away from people who are producing crops on it and turn it over to other people who cannot produce as large a crop, then you're going to have hunger. I mean, that's happened in Soviet Union. It's happened in any number of other places.
No, terrible. I talked last night on The Angle about what's happening on college campuses. We've talked about this for years. I mean, back when I was at Dartmouth, and I think I first interviewed you when Dinesh D'Souza and I were students there. Things were not good, but they were not like this. I mean, a conservative could actually get through a speech without fear of bodily harm,
yeah,
on a campus. And I advocate that for this, the only way this is going to stop is if there are severe and swift repercussions for,
yeah,
individuals who basically conspire to deprive others of their First Amendment rights, especially at these state universities where you have state actors. What are your thoughts on what should be done here to stop this? It's like a national campaign of terror against conservatives on campus.
I think it's hopeless to expect academics to have enough backbone to do anything that's going to affect that. What I cannot understand is why donors keep pouring money into these institutions that are creating a hotbed of, I guess, stormtrooper tactics, which is undermining the whole future of the country. It baffles me beyond words, because the donors are the ones who have the leverage. The academic administrators are going to follow the path of least resistance, whatever that may turn out to be. All you can do is make that the path of most resistance, both by the donors and by the federal government, which is pouring all these billions of dollars into these places that refuse to allow the basic rights of American citizens elsewhere in the society.
Tom Sowell, it is so great to talk to you. We love your book. It's not for people, by the way, who don't like to learn. You learn a lot in this book. So this is not like light reading. This is something you have to really sit down and want to really understand the economic consequences of social engineering and the supposed efforts on the part of the do-gooders to equalize everything around across the United States and around the world. And we just appreciate you so much. Thanks for coming on TV, too.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Tom Sowell, Discrimination and Disparities, a phenomenal book here on the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Thanks again to our sponsors who are supporting the show, including Genucel and Delta Animal Rescue. I hope you're enjoying this. Oh, the Laura Ingraham Podcast. This is the best of. And thank you for listening. We love your feedback. Always love your opinions. Want to hear from you. So you can email the show at ingram.podcast@gmail.com. That's ingram.podcast@gmail.com.
Calling all Housewife fans, you're going to love House of Kim with Kim Zolciak on Podcast One.
Get ready to fall in love.
Join Kim along with husband Croy and the rest of the family as she teaches her mindset of asking, believing, and receiving, and takes you along for the amazing ride known as her life.
And I thought about doing this venture. I thought, you know what? I have an eye for this stuff. I can do this.
Check out House of Kim every Tuesday and Thursday, only on Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.